16 апреля в 12...
Мы прошли пик проблем.
Рубль укрепляется, фонды ЕВР.
Вряд ли сейчас стоит ожидать снятия санкций, потому что есть сдерживание нашего развития.
Вы верите в статистику, которую...
Невозможно ставить на одну доску нацизм и сталинизм.
Мы не собираемся империю возрождать. Российских войск на Украине нет.
А вообще я баню люблю, хожу туда в России.
It happens every spring. The sun shines, the birds sing, the trees bloom, and Vladimir Putin holds his annual phone-in program, in which carefully vetted ordinary Russian citizens can ask the Kremlin leader any pre-approved question their heart desires. It's a highly scripted and choreographed affair, and it's hyped as if it were the World Cup or the Super Bowl. And it's closely watched by Kremlinologists for clues about Putin's thinking. So what was he trying to tell us this year? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me in the studio is RFERL's social media guru, Glenn Cates, who had his hands full watching and live blogging the whole four-hour Putin show Thursday. Welcome to the podcast, Glenn, and I hope you've recovered. I was worried you might need some psychological counseling after all that.
Thanks, Brian.
And joining Glenn and I on the Skype line from Moscow, where he's temporarily embedded, is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome back, Mark.
Hey there, guys.
Well, there were several reasons, I thought, to keep an eye on this year's call-in show. It was Putin's first really extended public event since his very bizarre and still unexplained 10-day disappearance last month. It came amid rumors that Russia was preparing a fresh spring offensive in Ukraine. And it came one day after Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov raised eyebrows by telling Russia 24 television that the Russian people were calling to demand that Moscow recognize the independence of separatist-held territories in eastern Ukraine, the so-called Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics. But what we got appeared, at least to me, was an attempt to sort of return to normalcy after a rather tumultuous year. There was the usual whataboutism. The U.S. and the EU have economic problems, too, Putin said. There was the usual bluster about how Russia will never be an American vassal, as if anybody was suggesting that it would be. There were the usual lies about how there are no Russian troops in Ukraine. But the majority of the time was taken up with domestic bread and butter issues, more or less. Glenn, you watched it wire to wire, as I said. What jumped out at you?
Yeah, well, I think actually rather than a return to normalcy, it's sort of the hangover from the past year. And what jumped out at me is besides John the Farmer, it was actually kind of boring. And I think Putin explained why in one of the final questions from the moderator when, you know, the moderator asked, why do you do this? And Putin said essentially, this direct line is like a poll with a huge sample size. And I actually think that's as honest an answer as you're ever going to get from the Russian president.
Although I would add a poll with a huge and self-selected sample size.
No. Absolutely, but it's still an opportunity for them to sort of think about what Russians are thinking about and address it in a way that's helpful for the for the president. And you know, last year Russians were still so revved up with what was then a budding pro-Russian separatist movement and the glory of getting Crimea back less than a month before. And in fact, I went back and watched some of last year's, and it begins with one of the sideline hosts saying, thousands have called just to say thank you for Crimea.
Right.
This year you had 30 minutes, the first 30 minutes devoted completely to macroeconomics.
Yeah.
And it was a full hour before any foreign policy even came up.
Yeah, and the nationalistic bluster was absent. When it came in, it was almost like pro forma. I mean, he was almost like he was reading from boilerplate.
Right. I mean, you know, he took the typical cheap shots at the U.S., which is to be
expected. I'd be surprised if he didn't.
But Crimea didn't come up until 3 hours and 40 minutes into the program. Yeah. Crimea was not mentioned until 3 hours and 40 minutes
that's
in.
That's pretty amazing.
But sort of stepping back, this sort of makes sense. Because, look, I think the Kremlin has to be relieved to an extent that to me at least, it doesn't seem like there's going to be the kind of economic crisis that some were predicting a few months ago. But it's still a tough time for the economy. Prices are rising, growth is expected to grow, and people are nervous. And while this may have made for sort of boring TV for me, I think the Kremlin clearly saw this as a way to say two things. First, I think Putin very subtly said it could have been worse, but I'm on it. And where it's really bad, that's probably the fault of your regional governor.
Which is the good czar, bad boyers meme that's worked throughout Russian history. Mark, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was interesting in a very dull way. I mean, first of all, I think we have to touch on the length. This blockbuster 4 hours thing, which I think actually has a meaning in and of itself. It's him, he's showing that he's fit, showing that he's in charge, that he has the entire encyclopedic statistics of milk production at his fingertips and so forth. So, I mean, I think just in and of itself, that was meant to be a signal that, you know, the Tsar is back on his throne. The tone, absolutely, in many ways, it really was quite conciliatory in terms of the international situation. With Ukraine, you know, he talked about Ukraine, but he talked about the fact that there wasn't a chance of war. I mean, he also said that there weren't any Russian troops in there, so maybe that's a sort of slightly alarming little juxtaposition. But he definitely was reining back, and I definitely would agree with observer Natalia Antonova, the journalist, who actually I know Glenn retweeted, who was saying there was a tonal shift this time round from triumphalism to actually real problems being addressed. And I think that also allowed Putin to go back to his populist roots. It's quite interesting, he had a little spat with Kudrin over macroeconomic policy, which, as we all
in
know...
In which he didn't answer Alexei Kudrin's question.
Well, of course he didn't answer the question, because what on earth is the point in actually answering the question when instead you can get in a bit of a sort of distance, obviously blaming in part Kudrin for the fact that these sort of...
My other question was, what on earth was Kudrin thinking being part of this charade? I mean,
because he's still loyal opposition. He's not an outsider.
Go ahead, Glenn.
And frankly, I mean, he's always part of this, and I think he has a role to play for Putin. I actually thought, I don't know if you agree with me, Mark, I thought that was one of Putin's strongest moments in those 4 hours, because it gave him a chance. Kudrin asks this question. He says, well, basically, Kudrin, you know, you wrote my economic policy. But then he says, well... You know, I take what a smart bureaucrat like Kudrin does, but I give it a little heart, because I recognize that economics is more than, you know, the words written on a graph. It's about you people in Russia. Mm-hmm. So I actually thought that was a pretty strong moment for Putin.
That's
Yeah, well, exactly. I think because it allowed him to basically present him. You know, it's a different spin on the whole. I am with the people against the boyars. It's also, I am with the people against
the neoliberal economic economists.
Exactly. You know, these comfortably padded, you know, living sort of nice, easy lives. You know, the same way as he also, you know, reached out to us. So we had all the various usual things of people saying, please come and solve our problems. And, you know, I mean, there was just enough leavening of little sort of snippets, again, just to try and sort of create that sense that there's a bit of fun. Putin saying that he won't be cloned.
Yeah, I want to get into a little. I had Glenn collect the weirdest moments for me. So
the best one was obviously the dog moment.
Oh, I loved it. I convinced
my husband that we can have a dog, which, I mean, clearly the answer is always yes, of course you should have a dog, but it ought to be a stray rather than a puppy whom you adopt. But again, I think all of these were attempts to sort of try and take what, after all, was indeed a very, very dull, in the main sort of four-hour epic, and at least bring the kind of the nuggets that other people can then pull out to show that actually Putin is a human being regardless.
Yeah, which heavy task indeed. But Ukraine took the back seat in this, but Ukraine came up, and I saw just before coming into the news, into the studio, I saw something that kind of raised my eyebrows. Now, we all know Peskov's comments the day before, right? This came out on the Russia 24. Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin spokesman, said that the people are demanding that Putin recognize Crimea. And every journalist who covers Russia's in the world's eyes perked up and said, oh, my God, is he going to make some big announcement? Or is he raising expectations and he's going to try to make himself look reasonable by saying, no, we can't do that right now? He really punted on the question. Actually, when it finally did come up very late in the game, he kind of punted. Glenn, if I'm not mistaken, he said this is up to the people, right? The people of Donetsk and Luhansk Oblast. Right?
Yeah, I mean, although I will say he didn't address Ukraine that much. He did sort of play the conciliatory figure. But I did find it interesting that he always leaves a little room there. He did say, you know, ultimately this is up to the people of Donetsk.
And this is key because he left a little room there. And guess what I saw today? The leader of the so-called self-styled Donetsk People's Republic, Alexander Zakharchenko, said he wants to hold a new referendum.
But why? They already had a referendum.
I know they already had a referendum, but now Putin said this is up to the people. Who knows? But these things don't happen by accident. I'm wondering if something's cooking. I don't know. I mean, you can go crazy reading these tea leaves, but it was very interesting. He said he was explicitly reacting to Putin's comment that it's up to the people.
I just, when I heard that, because when he said this yesterday, it reminded me of something Putin said on March 6, 2014. He had this press conference where he was a very blustery figure, but he said, literally like 2 weeks before Crimea was annexed, he said, I have no interest in doing this, but it's up to the people of Crimea. And again, I'm not saying that's what's going to happen. Sometimes you try really hard to read into these things, but I'm not able to do that.
But given where things are on the ground, the only thing that would surprise me is, as I argued in the Daily Vertical a couple of days, this does not serve Moscow's interests one bit if they do this. But one has to wonder. Mark, what do you make of this?
Well, I think one thing it did show is that the talk that there's going to be some imminent offensive with the idea of sort of winning some grand military victory before Victory Day on the 9th of May, I think is definitely off the cards. I never thought it was really on the cards. Look, Zakharchenko, we have to be honest that he's a Moscow agent and he's also a free agent. And therefore he's going to capitalize on these kind of situations. I mean, I think Peskov was as much as anything else precisely setting the situation so that whatever Putin said, he was going to sound moderate. And he very much repeatedly said, look, we're willing to make a deal and create peace. It's just Poroshenko, it's just Kiev, that isn't willing to do that. But again, there didn't seem to be much venom there. He was certainly not busy actually beating the drum, trying to get people interested in war. Now, if there is another referendum, it's going to hand Moscow a big problem. And therefore, I would have thought that actually they would be trying to sort of back away from any such thought. But, we wait and see.
So you think Zakharchenko's off script?
Well, either he's off script or else the referendum won't actually come with a clear majority.
Because I'm wondering now, because if you look at the situation on the ground, I mean, basically, do you see Russia returning to Ukraine control of that border? I don't.
Well, no, but the point is actually, let's be blunt here. At the moment, it's Kiev that is breaking Minsk II. Kiev is actually sort of brought in new restrictions onto the next stage, in other words, the sort of handing of autonomy to the southeastern regions, saying basically until they hold a free and fair election by our terms. The point is, Minsk II was never going to get to that point. I mean, I don't think anyone ever expected it to. They had to have this in the agreement so that basically the mighty crowned heads of democratic Europe could leave saying that we'd had an agreement. But the bottom line is, really, Minsk II was a ceasefire and a prisoner exchange with a lovely sounding coda that no one knew was ever going to go anywhere.
But one has to wonder if just, secretly Ukraine would basically prefer that these two self-proclaimed republics go. But they can't say that. And Moscow prefers that they go right back under Kyiv's rule, but they can't say that. It's as if, Wikistrat argued that both sides are fighting the wrong war. really. Well, Russia, Russia should want Russia. And this is a Wikistrat report that I cited on the Daily Vertical earlier in the week, that basically Russia should be wanting these republics back in Ukraine. Ukraine should be wanting them to go. I would put it a different way. Both sides, and Peter Pomerantsev said this very succinctly once. Both sides are trying to lose this war the right way, and they haven't figured out how to do that yet. No, but I don't know. I know, Mark, you prefer kind of chaos and cock up to conspiracy. But when I see Peskov's comments, the way Putin answered them, and then Zakharchenko's comments today, I got to wonder. I don't know. Of course, none of us know. But
Of course, sometimes there's conspiracy. But on the other hand, this would have to be a conspiracy that, if it's geared towards actually creating a situation in which Moscow cannot really but say, yes, of course, we will take these new parts into the Russian Federation, it's a carefully choreographed conspiracy precisely to do something which is very much not in Moscow's interests. Mm-hmm. Now, that said, I mean, just because I wrote that in the Wikistrat report doesn't mean to say that that's what Putin is thinking. But I can't help thinking that if they had had any real desire to annex this territory, they would have done so by now. They could have engineered this at any point. This seems exactly the wrong moment to be doing that. But on the other hand, I mean, we know also that the Russians enjoy playing mind games with Kiev and with the West. Mm-hmm. And it certainly would not be unusual for Peskov precisely to be doing that, to in effect be trolling the West.
Yeah. I would just add two things. I think, first of all, Zakharchenko sometimes just does go off the reservation. Yeah. Sometimes wild things. But the other thing is, I really have trouble sometimes trying to read too much into sort of how Putin presents himself one day compared to the next day, because, you know, you have like two Putins. Some days you have the Putin who's, you know, jingoistic, and other days, even in this past year, you've had this Putin who's sort of conciliatory, and we've sort of, every time he's been conciliatory, we've sort of stepped back and said, well, maybe, you know, maybe he's reaching out to the West. Maybe there's going to be some, you know, he's making some conciliatory gestures, but maybe this time he is, but maybe we don't know.
Yeah. And sometimes you have a Putin who's simply not there, like we had in the first, in the beginning of March. And this was explicitly not addressed. There was no question about it. Glenn, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think there was a question about. But yet, I mean, this thing had Moscow on its ear for 10 days, wondering what the hell was going on. Was he dead? Was there a coup? Was he in some monastery? God knows, or is he getting Botox treatment? Is his love child being born in, where the hell was it? Sweden or
Switzerland,
right. I mean, and this was not addressed at all. And you had to wonder, why didn't they prepare some pithy, you know, canned response on that just to put that to bed? And they didn't touch it. Are they just hoping it goes away? Is he uncomfortable talking about it? What did you guys make of that?
I mean, I would say, why would he raise it? Look, you say Moscow was, a small proportion of Russians were interested talking or even knew about it. I mean, bear in mind that this calling is for wider Russia. And if they had had a question, and even if he then had some pithy little response, actually it would have alerted people to something, that there was something there that actually in Pervy Canal land never existed in the first place. I think there is no way that they could have gained by having it there. Better just let it disappear.
I agree with you to a point, but I don't know. I mean, I can't imagine, even out in Pervy Canal land, that people didn't notice that Putin was absent for 10 days. I mean, that's...
But the thing is, you know, I had not even thought about it until you reminded me sort of after this Q&A. I think this was a big story last month, and he's back.
So they've mastered the modern news cycle and the short attention span.
Mark, were you thinking about it? I wasn't thinking about it at all.
I was expecting something. But no.
I mean, again, they only are going to put stuff in which they actually have reason to do so. Yeah. And exactly, I think once you've let the trash be taken out, Why do you pull it back in?
Well, the other thing I could think of is that his disappearance was connected to some deep crisis that seems to may be going on within the elite, and they just didn't want to touch it for that reason. We, of course, don't know. Glenn, I asked you to come up with some of the oddest moments. Mark alluded to some of them earlier. I mean, the few of them jumped out at me. What jumped out at you?
Yeah, well, first of all, I will say that, unfortunately for me, who's watching this thing, there were fewer, I felt, of these.
The poor guy was suffering. I fell for him.
but Mark brought up the one I forgot the woman, Yelena, and her mean husband won't let her buy a dog.
Yes, that's right.
And you know, Putin basically said, I can't, you know, your husband's a military man. I can't tell him what to do.
I'm the commander in chief, but I can't tell a military man what to do.
If you're good, maybe instead he'll buy you an elephant or even a fur coat. So he said he would sort of think about that. Then, of course, there was John the farmer.
Right.
Who actually our current time TV program had done a special about him about a month ago. He loves Putin. He loves Stalin. But he sort of grilled Putin about his milk farm. This is John the farmer is a British guy who has lived in Russia for 23 years. He speaks Russian very well, but with a marvelous British accent. And then one of the final questions was about whether Putin would clone himself.
Yeah.
And I actually thought, you know, I'm going to read into this way too much, but it was actually kind of instructive because for Putin to clone himself would be to defeat the entire purpose of his existence, because his sort of raison d'etre is that he's the only one who can lead Russia, and there's no one else besides him to lead Russia. And that's you know, sort of the way he presents himself to the people. So, of course, he would not want to.
How did he answer that? I unfortunately missed that.
He just said "niet."
He just said "niet." That was it.
That was it.
I thought the oddest one I saw was his telling the story about Gerhard Schroeder.
Oh yes,
the sauna, and the sauna caught on fire, but Schroeder stayed there and continued drinking beer. And I don't know what this is trying to say. I still have friends in the West. I don't know what he was trying to do with that. Mark, what did you, anything you found? Do we use them all up on you?
Well, I'll tell you what, let me just pick on a couple of those and just say that, I mean, part of me sort of wants lightheartedly to suggest that we're talking metaphors here. I mean, the Schroeder one is, look, the banyan may be on fire, but just drink your beer. That might well be a pretty good instruction to the people of Russia. And likewise, I mean, in some ways, I think the whole dog business was a perfect metaphor. You know, if you're good, you won't get what you actually want, but you might get something instead. So I think both of these count perfectly well for metaphors, for instructions to the people of
Russia. The cloning?
The cloning, well, God, yes, there can be only one. who knows quite where that came from?
The one about the little kid asking Putin how long he slept, which Putin pointedly didn't answer, and Putin is a notorious late sleeper. But that was kind of odd. What did you make of that?
Well, come on, it was just adorable. That kid was adorable. But although he didn't answer it, but he said that he would make a very healthy president if he did sleep.
He said a healthy president has to sleep a lot.
I don't. Mark, was there a metaphor there? I didn't do as good a job looking for metaphors. I don't think. Maybe you have one.
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm down that particular one.
Well, this before we move on to the next segment, this show has been running for 15 years, twice as long as Mad Men, more than twice as long as Mad Men. I love Mad Men. I wish it would run for 15 years, although because I personally would love to see Don Draper in the 80s. Is this thing losing its luster? Is it losing its effectiveness? Is it still effective? If so, why? Everybody knows it's staged. How long can this program keep going?
Well, you know, it's funny that you asked that because just in early April, FOM ran a poll, and it's 46% of Russians basically said they weren't interested in asking questions because this is basically window dressing. 46%.
Interesting. FOM.
FOM. This is
which
FOM.
Is a pro-Kremlin
right,
outfit, right?
Right. And they basically said we're tired of the format, and also, you know, nothing we say there is going to actually affect change in Russia. So there, you know, there is some polling that people are actually tired of the format. I don't know what it actually, how it actually benefits Putin's Russia, but there is some polling that people are in fact tired of it.
Mm. Mark, what do you think?
Well, I suppose we could start by saying, well, how often has the State of the Union been said? And, you know, sort of just because.
Well, yeah, but remember, he has that too. He has the State of the Union.
I wasn't talking about the Russian State of
the
Union. But, I mean, I think the thing is, I'd make two points. One is, you played at the beginning part of the wonderfully blockbusteroid trailer that Russian TV was using.
By the way, I love how they montaged that scene from Normandy with Barack Obama and Vladimir Putin, who were nowhere near each other at the time, but it was a split screen because everybody was speculating whether they were going to shake hands or not, and they were looking at both the split. But the way that in this trailer they montaged it, they made it look like Putin was right next to him, staring him down, and Obama blinked. It was a brilliant piece of video editing, I might add. But yeah, go ahead.
The very fact that they're having to use these techniques to try and inject some degree of passion and excitement into it, I mean, obviously demonstrates, I think, that they're aware that in and of itself, this is not necessarily a crowd draw. But I think it does perform a function. One is, as Len was saying, I think in some ways, the question submitted, never mind what actually gets chosen, is a useful and interesting sampling for the state of what's going on, what people's concerns are, in a way that we should remember that, I mean, the letters sections of the Soviet newspapers mm-hmm. were also a great way in which the Communist Party back in the day would try and find out what ordinary Soviets were concerned about. But at the same time, I also think this is one of the ways in which actually certain sort of broad lines do get communicated to the Russians. I mean, I think there is an importance in finding alternative ways in which, in a relatively unmediated way, Putin can actually give a sense of what's what, which is one reason why, for example, I think that if actually there is some sort of secret policy on the Donbass, on bringing it into Russia, then I think that would have been a sort of a badly mishandled thing. Mm-hmm. Because in many ways, he communicated one message. And if people begin to think, not only is this staged, but that it's downright mendacious, right, then there'll be even less reason to waste 4 hours of your life watching right. Putin talk about approaches.
So in a word, what was Putin saying to the Russian people, and what was Putin saying to the West in this?
He was saying to the Russian people, hold the line. He said that basically, you know, the Russian economy is going to get better. It might take 2 years, it might take less, but in fact, you know, we're doing surprisingly well considering that you know, everyone hates us and it's a sort of a bad moment.
The ruble's recovering.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's very much a kind of a line to ordinary Russians saying, look, you know, basically things are going to get better. Don't worry. It's just a little sort of speed bump in the road. And the line to the West, and again, there was that nice question when he was asked about who Russia's allies were. And he made it, so he went back to evoke the line from Alexander III that Russia's only allies are its army and its fleet. So, you know, on one level, it might sound quite aggressive, but beyond the usual sort of comments about not wanting to be a vassal state of America, it was actually relatively, I hesitate to use the word benign, but let's say not malign. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that is also a message.
I mean, just to add to that, he even sort of addressed that after World War II, the Soviet Union didn't necessarily do everything right in Central and Eastern Europe, which was sort of surprising to me. But along those same lines, I think you could also compare this to his December press conference, where the economic news was just awful. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the ruble had 80 to the dollar. And actually, you know, Russia's had some kind of positive economic news today and recently. And I think he really tried to sort of, you know, yes, the economy is bad, but like Mark said, we're gonna get through this. And frankly, it's better than it could have been. And I think he, in a very staid way, got that message across.
Mm-hmm. And to the West, he was saying, "Let's get back to business." Or
well, I just always find it hard to make judgments based on that, because he's done that before. Yeah, he's been conciliatory. He's seemed to be conciliatory to the West in the past.
Yeah, we've seen this movie before.
So maybe, but I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Well, in a few moments, we will continue our discussion and look at recent developments in the investigation into the Boris Nemtsov's assassination. I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me in the studio here in Prague is RFERL social media editor Glenn Cates. And joining us on the Skype line from Moscow is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the newly launched Daily Vertical at RFERL.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Boris Nemtsov was a staunch opponent of the government and myself. Although we had quite friendly relations back when we were in contact, I think his killing was an absolutely shameful and tragic event. I can tell you that investigators at the FSB and the Interior Ministry knew the killer's names as early as one day or a day and a half after the killing. The question was only where and how to arrest them.
That, of course, was Putin during his big call-in show commenting on the investigation into the assassination of opposition leader Boris Nemtsov. Putin lauded Russia's law enforcement for arresting the alleged perpetrators of the assassination and expressed confidence that the investigation will also get to those who ordered it. Reality, of course, is a bit different. More doubts have been raised about whether those arrested were, in fact, the actual perpetrators. Tsar Dadaev, the alleged trigger man, has said that he confessed to the crime after being tortured. He also said he fingered the alleged mastermind, Ruslan Geremiev, a close associate of Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov, under duress. And according to recent media reports, the investigative committee ran into a brick wall during a recent visit to Chechnya. They were prevented from interviewing Guriev, who is now rumored to have left the country. Mark, in a recent interview, the Russian security expert Andrei Soldatov said that those who ordered the Nemtsov assassination appear to have learned from the 2006 killing of journalist Anna Politkovskaya, specifically how to cover the tracks of the alleged mastermind, just as the case of Politkovskaya, the perpetrators were arrested, but the mastermind has not. How do you assess where the Nemtsov investigation is at this point and where this all is going?
Well, I mean, it's quite interesting, obviously, being in Moscow, in which clearly everyone has their own opinion, and everyone knows entirely that their opinion is right. And yet,
that's not just in Moscow. But...
really know. Well, there's a particular sort of fervor to it here, because obviously, you know, it's very real, and you can walk along the bridge and see the flowers and in the place where Nemtsov was killed and so forth. I mean, I think on the, you know, you have a whole variety of different perspectives, and it's worth mentioning that even just from talking to foreign diplomatic personnel, I've been struck that there is clearly not even a consensus amongst them about what's going on. There are some who definitely regard this as a sort of a Kremlin-backed hit, others who very much see it much more as a Chechen or somehow kind of an autonomous activity. What I would say is, I mean, I think a few things have come up. I mean, one is that from multiple accounts I've heard, certainly the night and the days following the actual killing, the MVD, the FSB, the Investigations Committee, I mean, they were all pulling people in off leave, getting people in the middle of the night. People were working long shifts and so forth. There was every appearance of, if not panic, but certainly that they were caught by surprise, rather than that this is something they knew was going down. Now, okay, one could go thoroughly Machiavellian and say, well, of course, they want to give that impression. But on the whole, the Russians are not, well, no one, frankly, is that good at making a sort of a cover-up. So, I mean, it certainly looks as if the security apparatuses themselves were caught by surprise and at first actually were launching a serious investigation. I mean, hence also the choice of an chief investigator. But of course, since then, exactly, you said the Investigations Committee has hit a brick wall. This has always been the problem with Chechnya. Chechnya is, let's be blunt, pretty much an autonomous state by now. Kadyrov, in the name of fighting the rebellion, has basically achieved exactly what the rebellion was hoping to create. In other words, a pretty much an autonomous Sharia state. So that in this case, it really does imply the Chechen connection really, really quite firmly. But also, it's patently clear that Moscow doesn't want to push that too far. At the moment, it's not that there's a sort of a straightforward, is Kadyrov stronger than the FSB or anything like that. This is, I think, from
Do you think that's what it's turning into, though?
Yeah. I mean, I think either Kadyrov was directly, explicitly behind it, or he has chosen to basically put himself behind it. One way or the other, I mean, I think the Chechen fingerprints on this. Whether specific individuals like Dadaev are the right people.
Right.
But definitely, as it were, the broader Chechen fingerprints, I think, are pretty clear. But I think that's exactly somewhere that where
the Gedimiev connection. Do you buy that one?
I think that look.
I mean, the connection went, you know, to Gedimiev, to Delimkhanov, to Kadyrov himself. That was the line people were drawing.
All I can really say is that certainly seems an entirely plausible chain. I mean, you know, when it comes down to it, all I can do is speak to people and put together a jigsaw puzzle that seemed to fit the pieces most effectively, but I'm still just playing with any.
But unlike the rest of us, you do this for you study this stuff for a living. And
so, yeah, I mean, I think so. For what it's worth, and I mean, I really need to even more than usual throw in the caveats there. Mm-hmm. For what it's worth, to me, as the thing is currently shaping down, it looks as if it's that way. Which actually, I mean, means that the sort of connection with past killings, I'm not sure if I necessarily want to draw them.
Well, the Polakovskaya connection, I think what Andrei was doing there was Kadyrov was also suspected to have been behind that one.
Yeah, but see, consensus in the interview, though, I mean, Andrei actually goes on. I mean, he basically says that really it has to be state security officers, is what he's saying.
Tied to Kadyrov.
Well, he implies the tied to Kadyrov. He explicitly says state security officers operating within Moscow. There I have a problem because I don't necessarily feel that actually that is the case. Mm-hmm. But I mean, again, I think, you know, we're all just sort of fumbling around. What we do know is clearly this was not just some random nut job or nationalist, assuming the difference between the two. This is not the Night Wolves or whatever. You know, these are people who clearly have some kind of stake within the system, shall we say. Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the pattern with Polakovskaya, there is a similar pattern where the trigger men were arrested, and then doubts were thrown in about whether they were actually the trigger men or not, and that makes everybody kind of forget. Oh, wait a minute, what about the Zakashik? What about the person who ordered this? Right? I mean, the pattern is a little similar, no?
Well, yeah, you say that, but I think it was quite interesting that you had. I mean, if you can link this back to the call-in. You actually had Venediktov and Khakamada both sort of, you know, raising this. Now, okay, maybe
That's another interesting thing. It came up from Irina Khakamada, the former opposition state Duma deputy and former presidential candidate, and Alexei Venediktov, the editor-in-chief of Echo Moskvy, asked this question. Continue, yeah.
I mean, so both of these are kind of, you know, they're opposition figures, but they're opposition figures who don't, you know, who have a sense of the envelope of acceptable behavior. One of them could have perhaps slipped in a question unexpectedly, but for both of them, I have to presume that basically that there was an expectation or an agreement that it was going to be raised. So, I mean, I think what's quite interesting is that this is not something that the Kremlin is completely looking to brush under the carpet. Now, sure, actually, the questions were not really answered, not properly, but the fact that, first of all, they gave Putin the chance to say how terrible it was. They actually, you know, very much had a chance to really explicitly talk about that. Yeah. But secondly, there was the fact that the whole question of who's behind it did actually get then aired on the big spectacular. So I think it's interesting this time.
Yeah, it is. He said, I'm confident there was the clip I didn't play is he said, you know, who ordered it? I don't know. Did somebody order it? I don't know. That's for the investigation to find out. Putin himself came out of the horse's mouth, actually.
Although just to add a little bit to that, I actually found the Venediktov part a little bit frustrating because Venediktov did ask, he said, how come investigators were prevented from talking to certain people in a certain Russian region? And Putin just flat out ignored that part of the question. He just did not address it.
And that in Venediktov was talking about Gedimiev in Chechnya.
I mean, he didn't say that name specifically, but that's what he was talking about. And what was frustrating for me, actually, is that Venediktov had a follow-up and asked about the naming of Vysotsky Street. So, you know, it was a chance to follow up on that. But actually, Putin completely, unless I missed something, ignored the question about a Chechen connection.
Yeah. And Glenn, we were talking off mic before coming in the studio, and you were saying it seemed that Putin actually seemed uncomfortable addressing this question.
I mean, at least the Chechen part he did not address. He sort of, I think it was important to my mind for him to get in that, you know, we may never find the mastermind, because to me that's a little bit of a step back.
There may not
back,
be one.
Or there may not be one, which is a step back from what he said the day after, which was, you know, I'm going to lead this thing and I'm going to find the person responsible for it.
Right. Mark, any other thoughts? I mean, what's going on in Siloviki land? I mean, it seems you said this created a bit of a panic. Is that resonating? Does it point to any other things going on in Siloviki land?
Not really. The amazing sort of sense I have had more than anything else while I'm in Moscow is the extent to which everything's pretty much in a holding pattern. There isn't really any particular big policy. People don't necessarily feel especially connected to policy making. You know, in some ways, again, the call-in show was a perfect metaphor for Russia as a whole. You can ask the questions, but it may well be that your question will not be chosen, and even if it's asked, it may well not be answered. Mm. I mean, this sense of disconnect from Siloviki, as well as just, you know, people in other realms of Russian life, is quite striking. You know, we've had the usual little sort of shifts around. You've got the former head of FSB counterintelligence, Cyril Molotov, moving to the foreign ministry, to a new sort of counterterrorism cooperation role, and a guy coming in who sort of has a background within the agencies, but previously was in a different one. So, you know, there's inevitably things happening. But what is actually, I think, quite striking is that after that initial pulse, I think once even insiders realized that it was the case of a certain Russian region, which again, it was worth mentioning, that almost always means Chechnya.
Right.
in Russian political discourse. No one ever thinks that that means to be a Tsar or whatever. You know, but as soon as it became clear that it was Chechnya, then actually from most people's point of view, it sort of, to an extent, I think it dropped off the radar, because you know full well that unless and until a very, very serious decision is taken right at the top of the power vertical, mm-hmm, nothing is going to be done about Kadyrov and his ilk.
When this happened, and one of the early memes and continuing memes that came out of the Nemtsov assassination was this rivalry between the MVD and the FSB, and because allegedly, according to this narrative, Kadyrov's people were closely tied to the MVD. The FSB had more or less hostile relations with them. That was happening amid rumors that that Kolokoltsev was going to get dismissed as head of the MVD and replaced by Zolotov, the longtime head of Putin's security. All the while, our favorite, we haven't said Bastrykin's name on the podcast in so long, Mark, but the investigative committee seemed to be out of the loop, or not out of the loop, but at least out of the spotlight in the early stages of the investigation. The FSB seemed to be taking the lead. How do you see all of these things that were going on independent of the Nemtsov assassination and then going through that crucible? What do you see there?
Well, first of all, I mean, I deeply question whether there is any positive relationship between Kadyrov and the central MVD. I think one of the reasons why that is assumed is that the Kadyrovtsi, the sort of the personal 20,000-odd personal troops of Kadyrov, are technically MVD troops. But the point is, as with all the other power structures, the Chechen MVD is not in any meaningful way controlled from Moscow. Mm-hmm. It's Kadyrov's people in charge of it. So it doesn't really matter what badges they wear and so forth. And that is something that is well understood and bitterly resented within MVD Moscow, central, mm-hmm, federal structures, just as the FSB is also hardly happy with the fact that its local structures are basically Kadyrov rather than, mm-hmm, you know, these things that are meant to be Moscow's control mechanisms on the regions. Actually, in Chechnya's case, have become bolsters of the region's autonomy. Kolokoltsev's future, well, I mean, I think he's, in some ways, he is the Silovik Medvedev, which is an awful damning thing to say. No, but yeah. I mean, actually, I have a lot of time for Kolokoltsev as a sort of a professional.
He's a regular cop, basically. He's,
yeah,
not a political.
Exactly. And he seems to understand what reform is going to need and so forth. But I think just as we keep speculating, or we certainly kept speculating, when Medvedev was going to be sacked. And it became clear that the answer is only when Putin needs to. Mm-hmm. Well, likewise, I mean, I think Kolokoltsev, he's now in position, he's doing his job. if at any point either a scapegoat is needed or Putin wants the NBD to become much more of a skull-cracking organization, then he's got Zolotov there in the wings. But, I mean, certainly just from some conversations with cops, I would say, actually, that's not gone down well.
They like Kolokoltsev.
They like Kolokoltsev, and they also like what Kolokoltsev represented. Because, after all, their previous interior minister, Nurgaliyev, whom everybody roundly despised, was a parachute in from the FSB.
Right.
And there was this sense that we have a political policeman put in charge of us who doesn't understand policing. Now then they feel it's not just Kolokoltsev as a person, but the fact that they feel we have a proper cop in charge of cops. And that says something about their professional status.
And the one thing I always thought that the Kolokoltsev's dismissal did make sense, because it was the MVD was the one of the Silovy Vedomosti, of the force structures, that did not have an absolute Putin loyalist in charge of it. Like you said, Kolokoltsev is a professional cop. He's not a political, and he's certainly not a Putin man in the way that Nurgaliyev is, or certainly in the way that Zolotov is. Mm-hmm. And that made me wonder, like, why are they letting that happen? And I always thought that would be the reason to basically get all of the, make sure all of the Siloviki were firmly under Putin's thumb.
But at the moment, there is no need for it. Mm-hmm. I mean, Kolokoltsev is doing his job. I mean, look, he's a professional, but I mean, he's a Russian police professional. You know, he is not some kind of liberal monkey or whatever. Given that, you know, we haven't seen sort of mass protests or anything like that, the sort of things, you know, which would actually make perhaps the disputes between what a professional cop wants to do and what a political policeman wants to do stark. Why upset the police apparatus and bring about these changes? You've got Zolotov. Zolotov is in charge of the interior troops, which are anyway the kind of the real serious end. At the moment, let Kolokoltsev do his job as a policeman, just as you've got Sergei Shoigu doing his job as an interior minister. You know, let the technocrats
as a defense minister.
Yeah, sorry. I mean, you know, let the technocrats do their thing. If it becomes a problem, that's
then
fine.
Then you
put in the political appointees.
Now, what about your old pal Bastrykin?
Bastrykin. Well, in fairness, I mean, actually, the investigations committee was also pretty quick off the mark with the Nemtsov case. Yes, of course, the FSB sort of...
They weren't front and center, though.
FSB grabbed the limelight.
Yeah.
But actually, I mean, for a political assassination, that's how it ought to be. Never mind the relative political structures. But, you know, it's worth mentioning that the chief investigator who was put in charge of this, Krasnov, comes from the investigations committee.
And he has a good reputation as an investigator, as a professional.
Definitely. Seryozhny chelovek. You know, he's definitely someone who knows what he's doing and works at it. Which, and the interesting thing is we haven't seen him of late much, which again implies, I think, to me that they're backing away from the real investigation. But Bastrykin doesn't tend to crop up unless and until there's going to be a result. Mm. Bastrykin cannot be associated with we're still investigating, we don't really quite know what's going on or whatever. Because Bastrykin is always so kind of politically fragile, I think we will see him emerge, you know, leap from a cupboard, if and when, they actually have something dramatic to announce, rather than just, hey, we're still hunting, but we don't really know exactly what's going on.
Mark, one last question before we wrap it up. You've been in Moscow for the past couple of weeks. Last time you were there was late last year, if I'm not mistaken. How do you see the change in atmosphere in Moscow over this time? What strikes you?
I'd say sort of 2 points. Remember, obviously, this is just Moscow, and also the people I talk to are much more right to come from certain sort of, you know, liberal and middle-class sets. But I would say 2 things. One is, I mean, the economics. It is quite striking how prices have gone up. And the stabilization of the ruble has not yet really led to prices going down. I understand the Kremlin is pushing certainly some food producers to do so. But in practice, everyone ratcheted their prices up when the ruble was really low, and they're staying up. And that is definitely hitting people. I mean, people are talking about the fact that life is a lot harder. And again, squeezing that middle class, it's a small middle class, but nonetheless, which after all was the basis of the sort of the Navalny, Bolotnaya and so forth phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Secondly, though, is actually, again, amongst the sort of liberal middle class, considerable despondency, great sense of impending doom. Not necessarily a grand doom. No one actually believes the economy is going to suddenly fracture catastrophically or indeed that there's going to be some kind of murderous revanche or crackdown. But anyone who can mobilize an escape route seems to be doing that for themselves, or if not that, for their kids. I think that the optimism of the Bolotnaya era seems pretty much to have gone. I think everyone feels that basically things aren't going to get better, and therefore how can they themselves do something about it? Although on the surface, life is the way life always is. Moscow is, after all, a tremendously vibrant and exciting city. But once you actually get people together, sit them around a table, and especially once you add a certain amount of alcohol into the conversation, it is clear how downbeat. And even people who aren't, as it were, the liberals who didn't like the system, but who one would regard as pro-system, or people who have been benefited from the system, they do feel a sense of drift. Mm. They do feel this element that there's a lack of clear policy, a lack of clear strategy, and a lack of clear engagement between their kind of people and the government. Mm.
Well, on that note, we will wrap it up for this week. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me in the studio here in Prague has been RFRL's social media editor, Glenn Cates. And with us on the Skype line from Moscow has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks.
And I'd also like to thank our producer, Jan Kaiser, who has been filling in for the ridiculously overworked Tanya Kancheva as she takes a much-deserved vacation from me, among other things. I'd also like to thank my totally awesome and indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome and indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the newly launched Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.